Hello, and welcome to the Inside EVs podcast for April the 9th, 2021. This is episode number 53. Our top stories today, GMC Hummer EV SUV makes its debut, an electric Chevy Silverado pickup is confirmed, the Mercedes EQS specs have been revealed. I'm Dominic Chioni, Inside EVs forum moderator and Inside EVs editor. Joining us today is Tom Logney, Inside EVs editor and host of the YouTube channel State of Charge with Tom Logney. We also have Martin Lee from the EV News Daily podcast, available on all your usual podcast platforms. And Kyle Connor will be joining us from Out of Spec Studios. He also puts together the devastatingly spectacular videos for the Inside EVs YouTube channel. Please subscribe and tap that bell icon for notifications. Okay, so gentlemen of the panel and ladies and gentlemen of the audience, welcome. Let's kick it off by talking what's charging, what's sitting in our driveways this week. So, Tom, I hear you have a Wallbox Pulsar Plus, and you've just put up a review a little bit ago on your own channel, State of Charge. What can you tell us about this thing?
Yeah, so it's not exactly sitting in the driveway. It's in the garage, and I don't have an EV to really talk about, a new EV this week. I will next week. I'm getting a Mach-E delivered in a couple days, actually a couple of hours. But for now, this week we did Inside EVs. We have our ultimate charger review series where we do real deep dives into home EVSE charging equipment that people would buy for their electric vehicle. And last week we did the Pulsar Plus made by Wallbox. It's a 40 amp charger, plug-in version charger. They also are going to be offering it in 48 amp version, but I had the 40 amp version that uses a NEMA 1450 plug. Wallbox is new to North America. It's not new to Europe. I'm sure Martin has heard about Wallbox. They've been around quite a while there. They've sold a lot of units. Very popular company for home charging equipment in some areas of Europe. So now they're available in North America. So we got a hold of one of the first units that came here, the Pulsar Plus, and did a full review on it. And I tell you, I was really impressed. Really solid unit, great construction, NEMA 4 rating. I actually, in my review, I blasted it with a garden hose all around it for like 5 minutes. No water got into the unit. Yeah, I put it in our freezer. I torture test these things. I put it in freezer. It was at negative 20 degrees for 14 hours, negative 20 degrees Fahrenheit. So I don't know what that translates to Celsius, but
cold.
It was cold. It didn't. We do that to freeze the cables to see how well they perform. If you live in a cold weather area, the charger's outside overnight, or your car's charging. That was one of the weak points of the Pulsar Plus. Cable didn't do fantastic in our deep freeze test. Wasn't the worst we've done so far, but it was by far the best. So while it's a good unit for outside, you see how in that video there. This is after I took it out of the freezer. You see how it remains coiled up? It doesn't want to stretch out and be nice and flexible and bendable. Right. That's what we aim for. And this kind of retained its form. I was having a hard time bending it. That's, you know, might not be important if you live in Southern California or Florida or so forth. But, you know, if you live in Northern State and you charge outside, these are things that are important. And really no other news outlet out there is doing this other than us at Inside EVs. So, you know, it's a really good unit. I'd be a little hesitant if this was going to be outside and you live in one of the northern states. You know, there's some other chargers that have cables that remain more pliable when they're frozen that we'd like to recommend. But other than that, it's a great unit. It comes with a really good app. It's Bluetooth and Wi-Fi capable. Most of these smart chargers are Wi-Fi connected, but this has Bluetooth functionality also, which if you live in an apartment complex or somewhere where this is installed in a garage, an underground garage, it might not have a Wi-Fi signal. But with the Bluetooth connection, you can walk up to it and you can schedule charging, you know, check your statistics, your previous charging sessions and so forth. So that's a little added extra bonus that other units don't have. It's interesting. You see in the video that Martin pulled up, just as an example, I showed the ChargePoint Home Flex. Okay. That actually has the best cold weather cable that we've tested so far. Now watch, this was in the freezer, just like the Wallbox. Watch when I unravel that cable. See how it starts to bend nice? Look at that.
Yeah, look at
the
that.
The other one well, remained all coiled up.
I wonder what's the difference like inside. Is the wire
it's more rubber. The jacket is rubberized. It's more rubber. And the other jackets are, see how that still remains even, right. It's all tight.
It's a different grade of coating.
Exactly. That's why we do these deep freeze tests because, you know, this is something that maybe for 90% of EV owners doesn't matter. Right. But for the 10% of people, it really matters. And it makes the ownership experience so much better when you can pull that cable out and it's nice and bendable and it doesn't feel like a frozen garden hose.
Sort of snap or break internally, or is it just a stiffness thing?
I don't think it's a matter of breaking, Martin. I think it's just stiffness. I think the jacket is plasticky. As opposed to a rubberized. Okay. I mean, we've all bought garden hoses. Some of them are, you know, they're bendable, flexible. Some of them, like after you've used them a little while, you know, they just bend and crack. I've never seen the cable crack like the jacket on these cars. But I know that I've had a lot of feedback from our readers that have complained about their chargers being very difficult to handle in cold weather temperatures. And one of the best EV chargers that on the market today is the NLX Juicebox, which I love. It's got great smart charging features. It's a really solid unit. It has the worst cable for cold weather that we've ever tested. Yeah, I can't imagine having to deal with that every day if I lived in a cold weather area and had and my car was parked outside, which plenty of people have to charge outside. Their units aren't in their garage. And, it's just those little things I think that we pay attention to when we do our full reviews. Whereas if you go online and you see some of the reviews on some other YouTube channels, they just kind of plug the thing in and then they plug in their car and they're like, oh, look, it's great. It works. It charges my car. But they don't do any. We compare the feel of the connectors, the cables, you know, the holsters on how the connectors holster in. So, I urge people, if you're cross shopping units, and you can see up behind me, I compare the wall box to some of the more popular units on the market today.
It's pretty small in comparison in terms of the footprint of it.
It absolutely is. And one of the interesting things I noticed, some of our European followers noticed that the unit for North America is slightly larger than for Europe. The European version, it looks the same, but it's about a half an inch smaller in each direction. So I asked Wallbox about that. Why is it larger? And it's because, you know, our electric supply is different here. And the connectors and the bits inside have to be a little bit more robust on the North American market. So it made the unit slightly bigger than the European version. But hey, this is a great addition to the EVSE market in North America. It's one of our top rated units now. It got a total final score of 4.6 stars, which ties it with the ChargePoint Home Flex and the NLX Juicebox as the highest rated home charging equipment that we've done so far. So take a look at it if you're interested in buying home charging equipment now. It's worth at least checking out. It's a really solid unit.
So a question for like newbies and people like me. Mm-hmm. So when you say 40 amps, what does that relate to in kilowatts in North America?
Right. So in North America, we're using, it'll be a 240 volt supply. So you divide the volts times the amps and it will deliver about 9.6, as much as 10 kilowatts, because sometimes you have a little bit high voltage. So, we like to round it up and say it can deliver up to 10 kilowatts to an electric vehicle, which is, not the most. There's some vehicles out there, Tesla vehicles, the new Mustang Mach-E, the ID4, that can accept 11 kilowatts or 11.5 kilowatts in that area. So it doesn't deliver the maximum that the fastest charging EVs can accept on AC currently, but it's so close that people really wouldn't notice the difference. One of the things we like to recommend is sometimes people go out and they say, okay, my car can take 11.5 kilowatts. I have to get the maximum the car can take. And I understand you're excited. You got a new electric vehicle. You know, this is all new to you. You want it to be able to charge the fastest. The problem is, it's not a problem. The difference you'll find from a 10 kilowatt charger and an 11 kilowatt charger is you won't even notice the difference with home charging. You're plugged in for many hours.
Yeah.
And the thing is, stepping up to an 11 kilowatt or 48 amp charger can be a noticeable difference in cost. You got to run a thicker wire. And now it has to be hardwired. A 40 amp charger can plug into a NEMA 1450 or 650 outlet. If you jump up to a 48 amp charger, it has to be hardwire. Oh. And you need number 4 wire, which is a lot thicker than the number 6 wire you can run with a NEMA 1450 outlet. So your installation cost is going to be more, and you're not going to have the flexibility of being able to plug or unplug the unit. If it breaks, if you need to take it somewhere else, you're stuck when it's hardwired. You got to call an electrician to unhook it. So I like the flexibility of having it to be able to plug in. And I recommend most people consider a 40 amp charger over one that can deliver 48 amps. You know, it's just, it's really not needed in 90% of the 90% plus of the situations.
Well, I mean, with 32 amps over here and you know what, home charging tends to be overnight. So, you know, we're at 240 volts and a 32 amp circuit coming out of my fuse board and going into the car. So it charges at 7-point-something kilowatts. And that's, you know, 10 would be nice. 11 would be nice, but really I'm never in a hurry at home.
How fast is your car capable of charging on AC?
The Zoe charges at 22 kilowatts AC. Ooh, so if I'm out and about and I find a 22 kilowatt AC post, and they're often free as well, I'm quids in. Not many cars can do 22 kilowatt AC charging. Not right. I can't think of many others.
Right. One of the things I'd like to point out, we got a question, not a question, a statement from Marty Walsh that said some places in North America use 208. He's referred to the voltage instead of 240. That's correct. Most residential installations are 240. It's typically 208 is usually commercial. There are some residential areas in certain areas that would have that. But most the areas that I've traveled in, at least, the 208 is typically commercial. So you do get a little bit less kilowatt delivered to the car because the voltage is lower. So you'd multiply the 208 instead of the 240 by the 40 amps, and that's what your draw would be, which would be a little bit less. But that's not typical for residential installations. That's more often, well, it could be residential if it was an apartment complex, I guess, a big condo complex, a building that had, you know, 50-car parking lot or 150-car parking lot. So, yeah, you're going to have a little bit less delivery, but I still stand by the fact that with overnight charging, I don't feel the need in most situations to jump up to a 48 amp over a 40 amp. Those 8 amps are really going to make such a minor difference. People aren't going to really notice it.
So if you want to see the full review of this Wallbox Pulsar, head on over to Tom's State of Charge YouTube channel. And I should remind you, he has like half a dozen other reviews on his YouTube channel now. And that's a growing number. And you can also search Charger Reviews on the Inside EVs forum, and we have a dedicated thread there with all of those. And as well, chargers are going to get their actual own sub forum soon. So if you have questions about anything about home charging, you can ask there, or if you have a cool setup you'd like to share, this will be the place to do that. We need yes.
So one second, not to belabor this longer, but there is an important fully electric posted that, you know, we need 48 amps even quicker if possible. There are times when my wife and my EV needs to charge at the same time overnight, and we schedule them one after another. So, yeah, I totally get that. There are certain situations, especially to EV households. Yeah. But now with the ability to share power on a lot of these chargers, so what you're talking about, from a 48 amp unit to a 40 amp unit, let's say it shares power. You know, you're talking about two vehicles getting 24 amps versus 20 amps. You know, again, it's not that big of a difference. Now, perhaps if you're doing them, you know, in series where you're charging one, unplugging it, charging the other, yeah, you want it to top off as quick as possible, even though you probably don't need to be fully charged every day. So I get what you're saying, and I'm not saying for nobody. I'm saying for the vast majority of people, I don't think that the jump between 40 and 48 amps is worth the extra expense in many situations.
Right, and especially if you're not driving very far. Like I still use the 110 volt, you know, portable charger that came with my Spark EV. Right. So, Kyle, nice to see you, man. It looks like you got a haircut.
Hello, I did a little while ago. And so, nice to see you guys.
I believe you're in Texas this week and spending a little time. You spent a little time close up with a Nissan Ariya, as well as some time at the huge Goodyear compound no pun intended, with its own secret Tesla supercharger. So you've told us about the RE in the past. In fact, it's like one of our most popular videos on the Inside EVs YouTube channel. So check that out if you haven't seen it yet. So what can you tell us about seeing it this time? I feel like the RE was kind of like a car you were lukewarm on. Then we'll talk tires.
Well, I was in LA for some electric stuff. Now I'm in, I was in Dallas for the Nissan event, and it wasn't just for Aria. They had every new 2022 Nissan model coming out. So you guys know on Out of Spec, we review not just electric cars, everything. And no new news has come out on Aria since I think we last reviewed it. So we really didn't do anything with it because there's nothing new to share. It was the exact same sort of design buck. It doesn't have a functioning drivetrain in it. Aria that we saw in Los Angeles when we produced all the videos. I don't believe anything new had been released since then. So it did make sense to just repeat and make another video. Good news is we'll have the opportunity to film with that car, of course, very soon when it starts to have production units or pre-production units. We'll be able to do some cool things. So my perception is pretty much still the same. It's lukewarm. It doesn't really excite me. I think when you look at its competitors, it doesn't do anything that those cars can't do other than looking like a Lexus RX. The side profile is very much new Lexus RX. And once you see it, you can't get it out of your head. Interior is still awesome. Really thick carpets, great center console that slides forward and back. Very usable space. Sounds like the e-Force all-wheel drive is going to be great. The biggest positive here is the big battery, or I should say the small battery, is available with all-wheel drive, which I think is a great, unique place to sit with in the entire marketplace. Now, the Mustang Mach-E has a similar option now, and we're seeing others go down this route. But could be kind of neat. Nice to see it again for sure. And my opinions haven't changed. It's going to be a really good electric car. I'm happy it's thermally managed. I'm happy it's CCS charging. We don't know how fast it will charge. We don't know the efficiency. We know it will do targeted 300-mile EPA in the front-wheel drive trim. But then you get into the weird stuff, which is like, why is the two-wheel drive version front-wheel drive on a ground-up EV chassis? You're just overwhelming the front tires by having to turn and have all that torque. So, it's a tough one to wrap my head around, that car.
Yeah, all-wheel drive is going to be the spec to get in that. I did have a question for you about that, and now it's just slipped my mind.
I wonder how Nissan are feeling as the year goes on, and that I think the ID4 has taken up some oxygen, and then Ioniq 5 and EV6, Hyundai and Kia respectively, that seems to have taken a bunch of oxygen out of the air, and then all of a sudden Aria is going to be coming this year, but it almost seems like the kind of the forgotten car. And over here as well, they've just launched the Qashqai, very, very popular family crossover is the Qashqai, just launched it with their e-Power technology, which... It's just a petrol car that happens to move with an electric motor, but it's a petrol car. And of course, they're trying to push that as an EV and saying, oh, drive electric with the confidence. What was the phrase? The confidence of having a petrol tank. And it's like, this is an organization that seems conflicted. They're like, don't worry about running out of range because you put petrol in it and it's an EV. You buy the new Qashqai with e-Power. And I kind of felt sorry for the Aria because at some point they've got to pivot and go, no. Petrol's terrible. Electric's really good, but they're selling so many of these e-Power units in Japan and they've just come to Europe as well that I kind of, like, where does the Aria fit for Nissan now? It's like, I feel kind of a bit sorry for it.
I like the e-Power concept, like the series hybrid thing going on, but, you know, they should have done it like, 10 years ago, really. So, but speaking of timeframes, hey, Kyle, do you know exactly or what sort of general timeframe we might be getting a hold of pre-production cars for testing?
Nope, but I know we're going to be pretty early on. So, look, the thing is, I think we can all agree, nothing really particularly exciting about the Aria here. And no one within Nissan totally, like that I've spoken to, like understands the car, gets EVs, knows the difference between CCS and CHAdeMO. Obviously it's not the engineering side on the US side of Nissan. Right. They're all fantastic, but they're much more focused on the new Pathfinder, the new Frontier, the new 400Z. This is just one of many products. And if anything, it's probably going to be the hardest for them to sell. So I don't really know if anyone is that excited about it right now.
The crazy thing is, like, Nissan was the first to market with an electric vehicle, like an affordable electric vehicle. And, you know, to Martin's point, like now they're like an also-ran with this latest wave of electric crossovers. It's like people, nobody's talking about the Aria. Everybody's talking about these other vehicles that are coming out now before them. And, you know, they beat everyone to market with the Leaf. And the exact opposite is happening now with the Aria. They're like the last company to come out with this, you know, this class of electric vehicle. And it's going to hurt them. I think, you know, if they would have come out 6 months earlier than the ID4 and the Mach-E, I think it would have given their EV program some oxygen, because they would have only been up against the Model Y, and Tesla's going to get their customers no matter what comes out. People are going to buy Teslas, but there are enough customers that maybe don't want to buy a Tesla for a number of reasons, an established brand where, you know, they're going to be the ones gobbling up the ID4s, the Mustang Mach-Es and the Aria, the potential Aria customers. But if they could have beaten Volkswagen to market with the Aria, I think, you know, it would have really given their EV program a boost. And now it's kind of like, I mean, I agree with all you guys. It's like, where does this fit in? And, you know, are they really behind it? It's difficult to see.
I think they miss Carlos Ghosn, don't they? I mean, he could be bombastic at times, but at least he was loud and proud about EVs and the Leaf.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think they miss him. I think they're happy to have combustion vehicles. No one within Nissan really has the drive, at least on the US side, to make electric cars. They're difficult to sell, right? They're difficult to explain, and they have really good combustion vehicles. You know, is Nissan really that forward thinking where they're saying we're going to transition by 2030 to full electric? First off, no automaker is going to do that. Secondly, I think they're realistic. I think they have one solid offering that's electric. The Aria is going to be a good car. There's nothing, I think, going to be blatantly bad about it. I think certainly Volkswagen will outshine it with ID4. Ioniq 5 is going to outshine it with its charging curve. But if you buy an Aria, it's way better than a Leaf. And honestly, their new combustion cars, like the new Rogue, I know it's not a combustion podcast, they're awesome. Totally turned around from Nissans of years past. And this is where the focus is on, increasing quality for the everyday, you know, combustion buying audience. I don't think they're interested in selling EVs at all, to be honest.
Well, I think Ghosn was more about, you know, just driving, you know, market share and a lot of product at the door, keeping, you know, good value for money and, you know, getting building up the Nissan brand and volumes and things. And it just lost focus in that with that, I think, with all the corporate drama that went on for a couple of years. And now that it's sort of straightened itself out for now. But, you know, I think they're going to find themselves like stuck behind the whole pack in like 3 or 4 years, you know, they have, because it takes a while to build up all the supply chains to do those things. So unless you have a big focus and a big plan going forward, because sure, they won't maybe be all automakers won't be all electric by 2030, possibly. I think GM's saying 2035, which is, but it's getting closer, and people have to be prepared. I know maybe you don't think they're going to be 2035. You don't think?
I don't think they'll be even remotely close. We'll see, but I don't buy it. We'll see.
Okay.
It could be a price thing. It could be that if they bite the bullet and it's below 30 grand, they'll shift them. But it won't be, though, will it?
No.
We'll see what happens. Look, I think there's a bright future ahead. I think you're absolutely right. If you look at just the electric vehicle space, Nissan's going to be very far behind. They currently are the last right now. If you look at current product offerings, CHAdeMO, no thermal management, blah range, blah styling. Great car. Still not bad. The Leaf's good. Yeah, but I'm saying look at they don't even make an electric car, right? But if you compare a Leaf at whatever they go for sticker, you know, dealers are putting 10 grand on the hood just to move these things. So Aria will be a huge step up from that. There's a loyal lover base of Leaf owners that are very excited for Aria. We've seen it here on our channel. I get messages all the time. You know, Kyle, I'm interested in Aria. I'm interested in ID4, Mach-E, or Aria. I'm like, how did you even remember this was a car? And it's the best performing video, you know, we've done on Inside EVs. There's interest here. And so we'll see. And I can't wait to drive it, because right now we don't know much about the car. We know its range, roughly. We know its battery capacity, 87 kilowatt hour usable on the big battery. We know it's very stylish inside. It's going to have ProPilot Assist 2.0, which is eye tracking, lane guidance, exit taking. Nothing here is bad. But we also haven't seen any individual points that are truly exceptional. But, you know, we'll see. We can't really talk about it until we get to drive one. We've driven every other car on the market.
All right. So let's talk tires then. So you're at the good – what's the name of the place that you're at?
Yeah, the San Angelo Proving Grounds for Goodyear. It's a 7,260-acre facility. I'm sitting in a tower that overlooks the entire thing. And actually, I'll take you on a little tour before we get into that supercharger. So forgive me if this doesn't look so great. So I'm going to take you over here to the right side.
It's looking good, actually.
Right. There's a three-mile dirt track over here where they do you know, F-150 Raptor, a whole bunch of other off-roading type vehicles where they test tires on varying different type of dirt surfaces. There's two vehicle or VDA surfaces, vehicle dynamics area. So this one, this major one straight ahead can be flooded.
Big skid pad.
Giant skid pad. That can be completely flooded with a nice thin layer of water. We took a Model S out on there yesterday and a BMW 4 Series. We were drifting around doing some tire stuff. It's awesome. Over here, just to the left of that, you'll see another sort of straight line area. There's a whole bunch of varying surface types of pavement and potholes and expansion joint simulated surfaces to test tire response on that particular surface. In front of us here, you'll see a Camaro ZL1 out there. That's the 2013 test vehicle. And Timon's out there right now with Josh, one of the drivers. He's awesome. They're getting B-roll and hot laps for some of the videos. I think we shot a total of 8 videos yesterday here. And a mix between their Tesla Model S, their Camaro here, BMW 4 Series. We're doing some Earth Mover stuff. You can see he's really shredding it through the track over there, right on the edge of grip, which is awesome. Yeah, really an amazing facility in general. Again, 7,200 acres. This is just a little corner of the facility. This is just where they do vehicle dynamics testing, but they have semi-truck testing, earth mover testing. So I'm going to go drive an earth mover here in an hour, which are those giant mining vehicles, diesel electric type things. You should, I'm going to do a whole video review, but basically they're powered by electric motors, generated obviously, but with diesel engines, but they regen. And I'm like, where do you put the energy? The energy just gets burnt off as heat. They have giant resistors with fans on them, and they can regen the motors because they said if you use friction brakes, they'll just catch on fire instantly because it weighs almost 1 million pounds fully loaded. So really neat stuff. A great tire torture test facility. You know, they can simulate hydroplaning situations, and we'll have plenty of videos coming out over the next few weeks from what we've shot here.
And they have a Tesla supercharger. How's that
work? Right. So Tesla uses this facility quite extensively because keep in mind the OE tire on the Model S is the 19-inch aero wheel with the Goodyear Eagle Touring tire with the foam on the inside. This gets over 400 miles of range, 412, I think Model S is EPA rated for. And at least for the outgoing model, maybe I don't know what the new numbers are for the brand new S. I haven't memorized those.
All right.
Basically, this is the OE tire, and it was developed right here on these tracks. So that's the Model S that Goodyear has. And because Tesla uses this facility so much, they put these superchargers around at various testing sites around the world. And they're not located in the car's map. And I have a whole video on how it's wired up and why it was here and how it works and all of this that'll go live fairly soon. But really awesome. Neat.
What channel is that going to be on?
Yeah, haven't decided yet. We'll see.
Okay.
We'll see.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah. So what can you tell? Have you spoken to them about the tire development and specifically? Because like, so if I want, or I was talking to or had an exchange with a Tesla owner yesterday on Twitter, and they want to upgrade their tires pretty soon, and they're looking at Goodyear's. They have a new tire coming out. Do you know of, or is this? You know, but any situation about that?
Can't really say anything that hasn't been released. And I'm worried because I don't know what has and hasn't been released. So I'm not going to say anything. But I will say there's a great tire that I think is good for like Model 3 Y type vehicle, which is the Goodyear Eagle Exhilarate. Goodyear Eagle Exhilarate. We ripped around on those on 430i's yesterday. And that car was developed specifically on a BMW 4 Series chassis, which is very similar to a Model 3 chassis. And we just found that that tire and chassis combination was honestly truly a perfect match. And that's just a replacement tire, not an OE tire. And you can go to any store and buy that.
Is that a low rolling resistance tire, or
I don't think it's not a huge focus on efficiency, much more on all around grip. They certainly have optimized tires for efficiency for like Model S, for example, the Eagle Tourings. Pretty neat. Tons goes into the tires. They have tons of different product lines. We did a lot of deep dive videos on this stuff, and it's super neat.
Right on. Goodyear does the Formula E tires too, don't they?
Not sure, to be honest. Hadn't okay. talked about I know that.
Yeah.
I know they do all of NASCAR tires.
Okay. There you go. And like you said, there's a lot that goes into engineering tires. It's really kind of crazy. I mean, hopefully you'll have some of that in your videos.
Yeah. Well, what we focused on here is not so much the design concepts of the tires. That's a whole separate team in a separate facility in an office building. Right. This is really the torture testing, the response testing. Basically when Goodyear's launching a new tire, let's just say, they'll have the engineers sort of say, here's our design target, whether it's from an OEM or for a replacement tire aftermarket. And they'll say, here are the goals we want to meet. So we think, based on the computer modeling, we should have this much sidewall stiffness, this much compound here, this footprint, and then this gets made in a mold and then shipped over to here in Texas, where it's then put on a vehicle where they'll select a average vehicle for the segment. For example, if it's an SUV segment, they might select a Tahoe. If it's a sports sedan segment, they'll use a BMW 4 Series or 3 Series or something that's representative of the market as a whole. Then they will put that tire on that specific vehicle, and that one car becomes the entire test bed for the entire project. So they'll get 25,000 miles, sometimes more, of just full throttle, full brake, limit handling. These cars just get ragged on. It's awesome. Full temperatures right up in the red at sometimes in the hot weather. You know, it gets over 100 degrees here and they're out wide open throttle up and down. That's kind of interesting. We spoke a lot about vehicle durability to handle their testing programs here. And that's a big thing for sure. That Model S has 18,000 miles of limit handling, basically.
Wow.
Man. So, Kyle, what you're saying is don't buy a used car from Goodyear.
Oh, yeah. If you see a used like BMW in San Angelo, Texas, there's not many around here. Like, just don't buy that one. They usually don't sell it. They keep them for the most part here and as engineering vehicles and pretty interesting to see. They take really good care of them. Warm up time, cool down time, plenty of oil changes, brakes, but the cars do get put through their paces because at the end of the day, they have to test their tires on something.
That's right.
I wonder if knowing how connected EVs are, and particularly Tesla, although all EVs are connected, many cars are connected now, whether the engineers at those car companies just ever, dive into the data and have a look at the hot laps that they've been doing, like back at the mothership.
100%. This car's on developer software to limit ESP intervention as well. So they put in a special code. Car goes into dyno mode that's fully functional. They work very closely, Goodyear and Tesla, because Tesla is the OE provider. So there's Tesla engineering vehicles here that I'm not able to show on camera. There's the supercharger here. The Tesla team comes and tests here at this facility. And so, I have to be careful about what I say, but their silver S is driven hard.
So when you say Tesla engineering vehicles, do you mean vehicles that maybe we may have not have seen in production yet?
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about that. Sorry.
Okay.
We'll get you one day. One day.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. That's fine. Right. That's cool. I have to ask though, right? So let's get to the big news of the week. And when I say big, I mean like huge honking Tonka toy, Hummer big.
Right? Texas size news.
That's right. All right. This is going to be a prime market for this. That's because the GMC Hummer EV SUV has made its official debut. Last Saturday, GMC released a couple of videos and a few pictures and some basic info on all the trim levels. Then on Monday, it held a media call and released even more details about all the features and then a whole raft of photos. And you can find those on the Inside EV's Hummer SUV post. I just do a quick search there and it should pop right up. So let's start with some numbers. The Hummer SUV is coming in five trim levels. The first two being both being first edition one, which is your normal decked out beast wearing a price tag of like $105,595. And the other one is the edition one extreme off-road package that starts even higher at $110,595. Now, if you want one of these, good luck with that because they're sold out. So you have to maybe, if you're really like set on like an edition one, you'll have to see it, wait for a canceled order or something.
Sorry to interrupt. Did they actually say how many required?
They did not.
Because I looked, but I didn't look that hard. Like, well, it could be like four cars. So.
It could be. Yes. It's kind of annoying that when they do that, when they have a special edition, but they don't say how many are in that special edition. That will probably come out eventually. People will want to know that, and they'll be more willing to release that, I think, as time goes on. But it makes you think that maybe they're not saying something because it's like it's a ridiculously small number, and they'd be embarrassed or something. So that's something to keep in mind, I guess. But there is still the next two trims coming will be coming out right after those first edition one vehicles, and also slightly cheaper. But if you can fit an elephant in a room with a bunch of these things, it's this. First deliveries of the edition one don't begin until early 2023. And that's like over a year and a half away. The regular production of the next two highest trims will start in spring of 23. So that's not too long after it does get rolling. And those are both strapped with the extreme off-road package as well. The Hummer EV2X comes with two electric motors, one on each axle, and costs $89,995. While the Hummer EV3X comes with three motors, two on the back axle, one on the front, and it starts at $99,995. The least expensive and least capable trim in the Hummer SUV lineup doesn't come for another year after that, though. And it has no extreme off-road package, two motors, and a smaller battery. A larger battery will be an option, though. But the base price is $79,995. Personally, I don't think they should even offer that, but there you go. So let's get back to some numbers real quick. So the biggest battery in the SUV has 20 modules, and that's in, I think, most of the big ones. And that's slightly less than the 24 modules found in the Hummer SUT, that's the pickup, which has a wheelbase that's 9 inches longer. So there's like less space to actually put a battery without, making like a little, like a penthouse thing in the back. So they wanted to keep the back rear load floor flat. So they limited the amount of modules, the size of the battery, just made it a little bit smaller. But it's still supposed to go, they say, 300 miles plus for a range on a charge, except for the edition one of the extreme off-road packages. That's down to 280 plus miles. But that's still not bad considering the massive size of these things, like, and those huge tires, and it's just so much. The battery should be about 200 kilowatt hours or so. That's huge, of course. And these are 800 volt packs, so they can take a lot of power when DC fast charging, about 300 kilowatts. Horsepower for the tri-motor is 830, while the two-motor version is 625. That gives the torque at the wheel figure, which is a ridiculous number. We can't compare it with traditional torque figures, but if you do the math, it's around 1,000 pound feet or so. But more importantly, it's enough that when you launch this thing in WTF mode, that's Watch to Freedom, they say, it'll do it in 3.5 seconds, which is kind of mind-boggling. Again, this is like supercar fast. So that's a lot. So let's start there. Tom, I don't know if you're a Hummer guy, but what do you think about what you see here? It's the fact that it comes standard with Super Cruise, advanced driving assistance systems with auto lane change, move the needle for you at all? Or,
well, when we discussed this back when the Hummer pickup came out, I was one of the strongest proponents for it and thought that it was a great move, and I love the vehicle. I know it might be. The price might not be the sandbox that the four of us play in and even most of our readers. So it's not going to move the needle in that regards where this isn't going to bring electric trucks to the masses. But there's a place for this. And there's plenty of people that have the coin that will plunk it down on this vehicle. I mean, we see the crazy expensive SUVs that are out there right now. And this seems like it will be that much better in nearly every regard than some of the real high priced, SUVs that are available today. I mean, I love it. I think it's fantastic. But going back to your original point, the killer to me is that almost 2 years we have to wait for this. That's really what really kills me. This, this should be coming out a couple months after the pickup truck. It's hard for me to understand GM's, planning with this. That were they really just that late deciding to make this, where they just physically can't get it out that quick? Are they battery constrained? Are they
bingo?
That's probably the case. But and that just goes to poor planning. This should be coming out, in 6 months. Rivian's going to have the R1S. They're really cool all electric SUV. This little startup beats GM to the market to where they're. I mean, let's face it, pickup trucks and SUVs, are what keeps GM and Ford going. That's where they make all their money. And now they're letting little startups beat them to the punch with this. So, it's I love the vehicle. I think it's great. But geez, waiting 20 more months for it, that's tough.
What do you think what is the reason for that?
So I think it has to do with battery supplies and batteries. They have the one Ultium plant coming up in Lordstown, Ohio, and that's not even supposed to start really production until next year. So, and the SUT, the pickup truck, comes out this year, at least beginning. So they have some battery supply coming in from, I guess, another LG plant, maybe in Korea or someplace. But it sounds like it's going to be limited. And they also have the Cadillac Lyriq coming out. And since they all share the same Ultium form factor cells, they're all competing for those cells. So, I think that's kind of basically,
Didn't GM realize this was going to happen at some point? Like, did they not realize that they would be shifting to electric? I think every automaker, even the ones that are down on electrification, they understand that they will eventually be transitioning. Maybe they just didn't think it's going to happen as quickly. I know not all of us even agree on how quickly it's going to happen. Right. It's going to happen. Kyle has on many instances expressed that he knows we're going to do this shift, but thinks it's going to take a lot longer than maybe some of us feel it's going to take. So, I guess that internal struggle happens inside of all these corporations also. True. Trying to decide, well, when do we go all in? I know intimately, and we've talked about this before with BMW, that happened, that there was a struggle back and forth with, are we all in now? Do we push it back one more product cycle? So perhaps that's what went on with GM. And, we could speculate and say, oh, this is going to hurt them because they're late. But, maybe it won't. Maybe they'll hit the floor running in 2023, 2024 when the adoption curve starts to really pick up. And, I think we all like to speculate on this, but it's disappointing that it's not out tomorrow. But, maybe that ends up being a good move for GM.
Yeah.
Maybe it's too early now to start making, 100,000 of these, Hummers between the two vehicles per year or whatever they're going to make.
Right. Well, they do know they have, produce more batteries, and they have they're planning on doing a second plant with LG, another Ultium battery, possibly in Tennessee. That's the early speculation. And these things take like 200 kilowatt hour packs. So twice as much batteries as, their top sedans or SUVs are probably going to take. And they expect this, this SUV will far sell the SUT. So I expect the first year of the pickup truck, the SUT, is going to be relatively low production numbers too. I don't think we're going to see a lot. We might see even more Cadillac Lyriqs. It doesn't have the buzz, I don't think, yet that the Hummer does. But yeah. So Kyle, you listened in on the media. You were there on the media call. What can you tell us about some of the features that I heard? Or maybe tell us about charging. Did you get any info on charging that?
Well, wasn't that funny? I asked a question to everyone. I was like, it sounds like it charges really great, but how does it curve? And they were like, oh, You know, naturally batteries are going to just slow down as you fill up. I'm like, thank you. I understand. What's it going to look like?
That's great. It slows down. And then when it gets to 100, it stops.
Yes. That's basically what they said. And I'm like, you've got to be out of your mind. Like,
I think you have to set, up the question for them. Like, you know, so if it gets to 80%, will it taper down from, you know, 300 kilowatts to 180 kilowatts?
Impressive part about this charging thing is this series to parallel in the battery pack for faster charging. It's the first and only implementation of a dual voltage system. Basically, you plug into a DC charger, the car says, oh, I'm in 400 volt mode, ka-chunk. Now I'm 800 volt mode, dump the juice in, and then it'll go ka-chunk, and it'll go back to 400 volt mode. And the reason is the power electronics in the vehicle cannot support 800 volts. The motors, the power electronics are all 400 volt rated, except for the DC fast charging. It's a neat way to save cost on designing an entirely new drivetrain and also take the benefits of 800 volt charging. But is it like, shouldn't, if you were just doing this from the ground up, wouldn't it just be better if everything was 800 volts? Who knows? The biggest thing for me about this entire call that we were on, Dominic, about this whole thing is, you know, this is so far away, it has the opportunity to change, and I'm not going to get too excited about it until we, you know, are closer to being able to drive it. However, I really like the focus on off-road ability here.
Yes, adventure, there is a lot of EV. That.
And one of the problems with off-road adventure driving with EVs, one is charging infrastructure. Great, we knew that, and I'm not sure how that's going to be solved. Rivian's taking a stab at it, at least. The second is going to be route planning for off-road, because certain trails are either very low speed and high grade, and some you don't use much energy at all. I mean, you're going so slow, you might be crawling, but you're actually not using that much juice. But what's difficult to someone like me who may be going on that trail for the first time is predicting my energy usage throughout that drive. So what the Hummer EV will have are popular off-road trails populated in an app. It's a smartphone app or built into the car, I believe.
Right.
And it will monitor basically your drive, and then it will monitor, it will save that. And then everyone else who drives on that exact trail in a Hummer EV in the same specification, it will save that. And then overall, it will do route planning prediction for off-road, just like we have for on-road driving. It will do elevation. It will say you need to finish the trail with 15% state of charge to get to the DC fast charger. And this is a really neat feature, because route planning, while important on the highways and is one of the most important parts of an EV, and it goes overlooked by almost everyone, off-road route planning is arguably more important. There's no cell service. You're in the middle of nowhere. You can't get a tow truck out there. And so this is kind of a cool feature. I'm excited to try this out.
Right. And it's a satellite view of too, right? And you can project it. So it's a smartphone app, and you can project that onto the screen in Hummer as well. So it'll be big there.
The CarPlay capable app, which means you should be able to use it across multiple vehicles, which is kind of cool.
Right. It won't be just the Hummer. It'll be the SUV. It'll be probably available on the SUT and maybe some of the other products GM has. So there was some other things about it. This thing, I like, my favorite feature about this is probably the glass roof. I like glass roofs. Not everyone does, apparently, but I do. And so how this differs from the pickup truck is that those panels come off. So they call it the infinity roof, and on the truck they have a place where you can stick them in the frunk, but in the SUV, you can lift up the rear floor, and it has like places so you can put it under the load floor, so you can stash it in there. Then you still have all the capability of that. It has got a huge frunk as well, same as a truck. So it's got keeps all that capability. So I thought that was a neat point.
You know, personally, between the two, I totally agree with GM's estimation that they're going to sell significantly more SUV than SUTs.
Sure.
It's a better looking vehicle. Plus, I mean, in that particular green, that's pretty badass, right? So very much
looking forward. It's a matte with a satin finish, right?
Yeah, and we've seen other automakers do this. New Land Rover Defender, for example, you can spec a satin finish now with a paint protection film from the factory, which is the first time I think we've ever seen anything like this. So it protects your paint as well as having that satin look. It's a cool truck. The problem here is it's a 2024 model year. That gives them room for them not to launch it in the beginning of 2023. That's unlikely. is probably going to be pushed towards the end of 23. And they're just stringing us along. We'll see. But I have very low confidence in seeing this thing come off the production line soon.
Right. So a comment saying, is it vehicle to load? Yeah, and it's a lot as well. It's like six point something kilowatts you can pull out of it.
Yeah. Sort of. It has a power state. It has an optional power station generator that can provide 3 kilowatts for it to plug in. You know, different. You know, whatever you want, tools or lights or stereos, whatever you want to bring out, lug out into the woods. But if you want to say you come across your fellow Hummer stuck or Rivian out in the trail who's run out of electricity, you can plug your truck into theirs, and you can give it 6 kilowatts at 240 volts, 25 amps.
Right.
Well, that's going to take forever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's better than nothing,
what are we
right?
doing here? We need, if we're doing vehicle to load, we need like 50 kilowatts out of this thing. Come on. Just right. give me a thick cable to carry around, cha-chunk on either side, and do some serious back and forth.
So one thing I want to point out for those that are interested in the Hummer EV is our sister site, Motor One, was talking about it extensively today on their podcast called Rambling About Cars. Okay. So it just went up today. If we haven't given you your full of Hummer EV, jump over to the Motor One YouTube channel and check out Rambling About Cars, because they go into Hummer EV for a while today.
Cool. So and even though they like stinky gasoline a lot, like Kyle, they're still really nice guys. And they actually,
I like stinky watching. Gasoline. You know, something about just making flames out the exhaust is a good time,
right?
Yeah, and they on their podcast this week, they explained the whole issue with it being shorter. It has fewer batteries, therefore it's got less power. But actually it's still 800 and whatever it is horsepower. And so like, how much power do you, how much
that
power
was really
do you really
funny.
Want?
When Dominic and I were on this, briefing after the launch, people were asking, first off, the silliest questions. Secondly, they were like, well, why does it only have 800 horsepower? And I'm like, you know, it's not going to be slow. Come on.
3.5 seconds to 60. And the size of this thing is hulking. It's like, and
on those tires?
No. They're like, what, 35-inch tires or something?
No, Chuck. Someone walks out in front of you when you're doing speed in a Hummer. I mean, no, thank you. On those tires? No, thank you. Nah, no. Although this podcast gone very meta, because we're now, if you're watching the YouTube version, showing a podcast of our colleagues doing a podcast about an electric car on an EV podcast. So I'll just go back to that view and it'll just, my brain is normal again.
All right. So I don't know if there's any. Else we want to hit here real quick. When we're still, it has extract mode. The body that raised up 6 inches. It's got really.
It's all
short
the same
base.
Stuff as the SUT.
Yeah.
Well, you can get in more places than the SUT.
Yeah, just a shorter wheelbase, better approach departure angles. Yeah. No one's going to off-road these things. They're going to drive them around Miami, and that'll be that.
One thing I don't understand, you guys are always telling me that US has a truck culture. Every other car on the road is a truck, and it's different to here. And yet they've said they're going to sell way more of the SUV than the truck, whereas haven't Rivian said they're going to sell more of the truck than the SUV? So what's
I don't think Rivian said buying... that. I thought Rivian was also SUV was going to be.
Oh, more. Are they?
I think Rivian's probably looking at the SUV going too. Yeah.
So when you get a choice of both, you're buying the SUV, not the truck.
Yes.
But for
because no one needs the truck. No one needs the flatbed on a Hummer.
It's not that. It's the use case for a truck. The electric doesn't work for it yet for a pickup. Out here in Texas, for example, where more trucks are sold than anywhere in the country, huge distances, we're talking 200-300 miles a day with giant trailers, high speeds, 85, 90 miles an hour. Speed limit's 85 out here. It just EV doesn't work for that yet. But for an SUV, mommy wagon, driving the kids to school, perfect all day long for that kind of stuff. Or
even with
Miami.
200 kilowatt hours, it's going to eat through. If you start towing, it's going to eat through that. So
Your range gets cut 75%. If you're towing a big trailer, it's more to do with aero than weight, though.
Right. Depending on the profile of the thing. Yeah. That's something we need to explore, and automakers need to. I was hoping someone would ask about that on the call. They didn't answer my question, but I was hoping somebody would ask about the towing thing. Let's move on a little bit because we're already using a lot of time up. So GM also chose this week to slip out a bit of news about its electric Chevy pickup truck. They didn't give out a whole lot of details, but enough to get an idea where they're going with this. They're calling it a Silverado, with the E in the Silverado a blue on the logo. And they're saying it will get 400 miles of range. So what that tells me basically is that it's a two-motor Hummer drivetrain with the full 24-module Ultium pack that's in the Hummer pickup truck, SUT. I would not be surprised, though, if they also make a single-motor version with a smaller battery, and so that there's a more affordable way to get into one. Now, I believe the concept version of this truck was teased a while back last year at the Barclays Global Automotive Conference. And I believe we have an image of that. Yes. So if you can see behind this guy, you can see it looks a little bit like the Hummer SUT profile, and like over the bed part, there's a bit of an angle there, which, you know, I don't really like, because it reduces maybe the functionality of the traditional pickup bed. But you can, if you see it, look like the little bit of the front, that's a little bit like the it reminds me of the Silverado, the heavy duty version. I think Silverado has a few different front ends, grills on their trucks, but the heavy duty version is like that kind of retro throwback, big blingy chrome grill. And I think it's going to lean that direction a bit. Yeah. So what do you think, Tom?
Well, you know, we knew it was coming. It's just a matter of when. And evidently, you know, this is another vehicle that's going to be held up maybe by battery supply. This is something else that they're talking, at least 2023. You know, no big deal. We knew that'd be offered an electric pickup truck. I just hope that they take the opportunity to put in some, you know, new features. Like, they don't just make an electric Silverado with no changes. Like, the vehicle to load, it's obviously going to, I would assume it would have that if the Hummer EV is going to have that. How about some really cool storage compartments? Like Rivian with their pass-through. I'm not saying that specifically, but something like that. Take advantage of the fact that this is a completely new platform with a clean sheet of paper, and make it more usable. Make it, you know, improve on the pickup truck. Don't just, you know, change the powertrain. Make it a more user-friendly vehicle that has more utility. It's interesting how the companies are going to be integrating the front trunks, you know, how they're going to work. Was the grill going to fold forward? I think it kind of has to. That's one of the things that I was always a little concerned about with Rivian, because it doesn't fold forward. I remember the first time I saw it, it's got this huge trunk that's really deep. And I'm not tall. I'm only 5'8". And I'm imagining myself trying to pick something up and get it into that, and then with my bad back trying to lift it out. You know, having the grill on the front flip open like a tailgate, so you could slide stuff in and out, really makes the front trunks a lot more usable. So, I mean, you know, things like that make this vehicle not just an electric Silverado, make it a better electric Silverado.
Right. That's a good idea. I have a good point with that, because on the Hummer, I think the grill is incorporated into the hood. So that whole thing, so you can load things in there easily, but you also run the risk of maybe banging your head on the thing, which I don't know. So having a little table there that fold down, you know, that's like extra utility. I think the Canoe Electric had a little bit of that going on. It had a very small front thing, but yeah.
Right. But still, it folds open. You can sit your laptop on it. You could, you know, you could eat lunch on it if you're somewhere. It's got the power outlets right there. Canoe, really, I loved how they incorporated that. And I know it doesn't have a huge front like you mentioned, but I think for the space that they had, they did a great job with laying that out.
Right. Kyle, what do you think of the Silverado?
Cool. We'll play around with it when it gets here.
Right. I think it's going to be so this could be another reason why the Hummer SUV is so late, because if they're planning on producing this will be a more of a volume vehicle, I think, than any of the Hummers will be, because it'll be more affordable and have at least some of the capabilities and maybe all the capabilities if they do, like, you know, high end packages.
Maybe we've yet to see a successful electric pickup truck yet. There's no market basis to say, well, because X went really well, Y should perform about the same. I think we'll have to judge, you know, with Rivian, I think it's going to be first to market with an electric pickup. Yeah. We're probably going to see a huge influx. And then what will tell the story is, does it drop completely or does it sustain the sales? You know, you're going to have a peak, but once it comes off, how low is it going to drop after those initial orders are fulfilled? Really hard to say. Look, I ask people all the time, wherever I go, you know, what do you think about electric trucks? And it's very much a mixed bag. It's, I love my diesel. I need range. You know, I don't want to worry about charging. And again, the more weight you have in the truck, the less you can haul. So for the real people who work with their trucks, I'm not sure it's going to work. For people who just drive their trucks around, throw hay in the bed, work on a ranch, whatever, stuff like this, it's much more attractive, I think. So right. We're going to have
– And there are a lot of those people, Kyle.
Tons. Oh,
if there are a lot of those people
who work them. I agree, Tom.
I think that three second 0-60 is going to be – just knowing like a lot of younger guys like that kind of thing.
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think it matters. The trucks are quick enough. When's the last time you saw someone launch control out of a stoplight randomly in the public? I see people just cruise around normally. I'm the only one who's like burning tires.
Wow.
Like it's a good bragging thing, right? But in true practical use, you're never going to you're going to have stuff in your vehicle.
I mean, these are off-roading stuff. So, you know, doing that off-road, I don't know. We
have
guys.
You're not launching off-road. You're working with this much space. It's not, I don't think acceleration is needed in these types of big trucks. I think it'll be fun here or there. There's many different types of truck buyers. They will sell. They'll sell every single electric truck they can make. The question is, where are they going to be used? And are they being used for their intended purpose? And we don't have the answers. It's going to be really fun to watch unfold. That's why it's fun to be in our position, because we get to report on the vehicles and then we get to see them out in public and we get to listen to the forums and figure out how are people actually using this stuff. You know, most people buy a long range Model S with all the range and then commute 20 miles to work. That's a waste of batteries. You know, why are you hauling around all that stuff? Cool. You can buy it. Great. Awesome. They're having a good time with their car. They have range confidence. All that's awesome. But again, not really a total use of that vehicle.
All right. So let's move on to something else then. We've talked about the Mercedes EQS some last week. They showed off some of the interior with an emphasis on the big glass with the three screens. And they let us know that it has a 0.20 drag coefficient, which is, I believe, the most slippery drag coefficient of anything made today. The only production vehicle I can think of that could beat it would be the VW XL1, which was a 0.19, and they made it was a two-seater plug-in diesel hybrid.
Yeah, but it wasn't a series production. They just made handful.
They made 250 copies in 2013.
So
it's not like a big production. It's not. Yeah, it's how you label what a production vehicle is.
Well, I think that's why they use series production. When they mentioned that label, because it's a model series.
Right. So the big reveal is next week, but they still dropped a bunch of info on it this past week. In fact, Kyle, you had two videos about this car in this past week. One is on the Inside EV's YouTube channel, in which you had a virtual drive along with a Dr. Fabian Wettke, who is the project lead of sedan development for Daimler. And then another one on the Out of Spec Reviews channel. That's an hour-long deep dive into the EQS details. So let's maybe start by telling us about the battery options and charging, but let's also get to the special motors because that really grabbed my attention.
Sure. So I'm trying. Again, it's so hard to figure out when embargoes close or open, but this car is going to be badass in the most luxurious way. Not so much focused on total range, but total vehicle. You're getting the best of an electric vehicle drivetrain that may not be Lucid level of tech. I think Lucid still has the edge in everything we've seen from them. Really high voltage. This is a 400 volt system architecture, by the way. Lucid, I think, is going to have the best drivetrain technology out there on the market. I think Tesla is going to be the most vertically integrated, easy to use, easy to own, great connected experience. And that's why many people buy Teslas. And I think this is going to become the luxurious option. This is, you know, executive rear seat options, very plush car, really high quality leathers throughout, nice touch points. The exterior styling, I need to be careful, is it's like looks like an egg, right?
Have you seen it?
I can't say anything about that. Okay. It's
we should tell you what we know about it, and although we could make stuff up to see if you can. Like, we know about the doors, got like Model X doors, so you walk up to the car and they open,
that's
and then you
true.
Just get in the car. and then they close, and it's not exactly the same.
Two battery options.
Yeah.
Two battery options, but in the US, only one.
Okay.
In the US, you'll be able to select a rear-wheel drive long-range version or an all-wheel drive, a little bit lesser range, same battery pack. You just lose a bit by having the extra motor and weight. Going to be a real serious car. Tons of technology. I did a whole hour-long deep dive on just the little details here or there. We've spoken about it on the podcast. Tom totally agrees with me. This needs to be the pinnacle of luxury for an electric vehicle. I think it's the only thing Tom and I agree on is the S-Class has to be perfect. And, yeah, you know, we agree on a lot. But it's got to be a good car. And I can tell you from the technical presentations that I've attended, it's really good.
There's a lot of technology going on here. Power wise, it's only like 513 or something.
Doesn't need to be fast. It's about comfort.
Right.
Launching so hard is not comfortable.
So we don't know the 0-60 yet, do we? I think maybe we do it.
No, but it's not going
like to. Oh,
yeah, four is somewhere around there. Yeah, maybe high threes, low fours. But that's fine. Look, you're not buying this to go launch it down the drag strip. You're buying this to drive, up and down the California highways, cruising around to your business meetings. This is an executive luxury sedan. This is the top. They will have EQE, EQC, smaller versions. Both SUV and sedan that will be electrified, that will be more mass market. This is the halo electric car. When you see someone cruising around in the EQS, you're like, they mean business. And that's going to be the car. It has this massive hyperscreen, 56 inches totally across. It has three displays behind. Now, personally, I would not spec the hyperscreen. I would get the standard 12.8 inch display. You get a nice wood dash behind. The hyperscreen is not a consistent screen. It is a beautiful one piece of glass that was, and Mercedes goes, they shared so many details with us all in this video, but things like they had to cure the glass at 1202 degrees Fahrenheit just to make it, this thing. I love all those little details.
Yeah.
But the passenger display doesn't work unless
you want you don't want your passengers to have any glass in front of them. That's all for the drive. Basically, what you're saying is Alyssa cannot have her own screen. She just gets the dashboard. It's all for you.
Right. Well, it kind of makes sense because, let's say 80% of the time, it's just going to be me in the car, right? So why would I pay for a passenger display that doesn't work? Also, I really like to have wood in a car. I like craftsmanship. I love to see these little fine details. This screen is just this piece of glass. I love this comment. Kyle actually talks with his hands in this position. It's very true.
but it does it does look nice when you see. I'll try and find a picture of the normal dash. It looks
it's way nice. I don't know what's been released and what's not, but you cannot get anything but the hyperscreen on the top spec here in the US.
Oh, I see. Hey, so it does get like a huge number. It's got like 107 kilowatt hour. 0.8 kilowatt hour battery
usable
and with 479 miles under the WLTP test cycle.
So let's say 400.
Okay. EPA. So 400 miles. So how they're doing that possibly is I think the motor, besides the slippery drag coefficient, it's got this really interesting motor. Now, do you know a lot of details about that? It's got like two sets of, usually it's a, what do you call it? A three,
Well, you normally have a three phase motor in the rear, right? So what you have in the front motor is a standard three phase permanent magnet motor, nothing totally special going on up there. The rear motor are two, three phase operations. So you have a total of six phases with, the copper windings as well are not all straight. They go in a little bit of different direction. And what this does is it means that at low speed under high load, well, first off, you can get more total power. You have more pulling force in the motor. You also have the reduction of motor cogging, which is something the Mustang Mach-E does really really bad. But it's not something you notice much. It's when you're on a steep hill at low speed, you can feel it chunk, 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 chunk. And it kind of makes this low grumbly noise. To Mercedes, this is unacceptable, of course. So they had to go way out of their way to make it a smooth acceleration process below 1 mile per hour under a steep grade.
Wow. And so I think this is also going to be, as you say, they're going to maybe use one set of windings at one speed and then a different set of,
I don't think that's possible. I think they have to run both phases at the same time.
Can they give one set of phase like a different amounts of energy than the other set though to make?
I don't think there would be a more need efficient for that.
At different speeds.
No, I don't actually think that would make it more efficient. The motor's okay. spinning at a given rate. I'm pretty sure it's all the same. Okay. You're just having more opportunities to pull the motor along. So you'll have a reduction of heat loss because for each individual phase, you'll have less force going through, less current going through each one. But this is all minor stuff. The main benefit is more power, and less cogging and
smoother delivery.
Yeah, not even so much in an efficiency benefit. That's a byproduct. It's just a minor right. thing. But again, this car isn't meant to be max range, max all this stuff. This is a really nice blend of current technology, battery pack architecture with a relatively efficient drivetrain, with a great charging curve and awesome route planning. This is going to kind of be like a really good hits all the marks goes around.
I mean, you've spent time with Mercedes-Benz, but from everything I've read, that they've talked about how they've engineered this themselves, they seem to put real pride in the fact they haven't gone out and just bought stuff off the shelf, that they've designed this themselves. They can do over-the-air updates as they learn more about EVs. Yeah. They can apply those updates over the air. They're admitting they haven't got like all the knowledge they want yet, but as they make more cars and more miles get driven, those cars will get better. But they seem to go out of their way to say, look, we've worked really hard to do this ourselves, to understand it, not just assemble a bunch of bits and get a car on the market as quick as possible.
Yeah, well, certainly they did go to tier one suppliers that are moving to electric and kind of pull things together. I wouldn't say, certainly they may have designed it all, but they're also outsourcing a lot of their stuff. It's not 100% in-house, but it's not like they went to another company and bought a chassis and then put the car on top, which is correct. A big deal. I mean, there's a lot of pride in German engineering. Especially. Right. And so for Daimler to go out and just buy someone else's electric vehicle architecture, that's like the lowest of the low thing they could ever do. Zero pride in that. And so here, you're taking 100+ years of Mercedes-Benz Daimler engineering and putting it into a really great effort, luxury electric vehicle that they're thinking about the entire user experience. Think about how many cars on sale right now, Mach-E, ID4, even some Taycans now for 2021, it's getting better. They do not route you very well through the charging experience on a road trip. And you need the most amount of handholding possible. And Mercedes is like, tell me what percent you're comfortable arriving at the charger with, and tell me what percent you want to arrive at home with. And it will just map it all out. Actually, I'm not going to share it with you. I'll share it with you in a few days. Sorry.
Such a tease.
When we do the DC fast charging, we do know that it'll go up to 200 kilowatts. And so that will give you, in 15 minutes, if it's at a relatively low state of charge, you can get 186 miles of WLTP's worth of range in like 15 minutes, which is pretty good, right?
Yeah, well, that's WLTP. So it is really not. Yeah.
160 miles.
Yeah, that's fine. Hard to really manage that because, of course, on highway, your speeds are going to be significantly higher and likely not going to match EPA. So all of these, like, look how many miles of range you can add in this time quoted. They're all based off of usable numbers for the city mixed in with the highway. Nothing you'll ever get on the highway, which is when you're DC fast charging. The nice thing, though, is I was talking to Fabian a little bit, the sedan lead for Daimler. And he mentioned that it will do 200 kilowatts all the way to 80% roughly. He said it might taper down to like 170, 180 up there, but it's still, pretty high up, which is a nice,
great.
Nice.
That's better than Audi, right? Even?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Has on route preconditioning for DC fast charging. And the big deal here, 290 kilowatt regen.
Right.
Which is more than any vehicle ever.
The Taycan comes close to that, though, right?
265.
Yeah, I knew it came close. Yeah, that's great. That's fantastic. Well, one of the things, not to criticize Mercedes, this isn't criticism at all, but think about Lucid. Lucid, with their Air, has about the same size battery pack. It's 113 kilowatt hour. And that's they're saying that's going to be EPA range rated at over 500 miles. Think about powertrain efficiency, you know, and you know, this is great that this is probably going to be EPA range rated at over 400 miles, which is fantastic, more than what almost anybody needs that's going to want this to buy this car. But it just shows, it goes to show you how the startups like Tesla, like Lucid, how they can really just focus on one of the most important factors in electric vehicles, and that's powertrain efficiency, and like, and just nail it. And these established brands. I mean, Mercedes is, you know, the benchmark, a pinnacle of you know, luxury with the S-Class. And while they seems like they got a lot right, and I'm not, like I said, I'm not saying this to criticize Mercedes. I think that actually 400 miles is great. They still can't develop a powertrain that can match what some of the startups can. And that speaks volumes to me in how electrification is going to advance in this next decade or so, you know, yeah. And how the startups, true. You know, a startup never had an advantage over legacy brands. That's why it was so hard for companies to start up. We have had so few automobile companies started and succeeded in the last 50 or 60 years. But now we're getting startups and they're succeeding. And, you know, which is exciting times.
So that means that just underlines what Kyle was saying, that they really have to get what they already can do really well, even better. So like the noise and vibration and handling sort of things, like the beading in the welds are, you know, designed with all that in mind. There's like acoustic dividers in the tailgate to reduce like booming noises.
Yeah, the Mercedes could have taken so much weight, unnecessary, you know, sound deadening out, and made it probably more efficient, but they could not have matched Lucid. I don't think anyone can match Lucid's powertrain technology. We'll see, we'll see what Tesla is doing. We don't know much about their next generation stuff yet. We don't know what's going into Plaid totally, but right. I think it's going to be a Tesla versus Lucid race, and it's going to be real exciting to watch.
Right. But I think still, if you want like the ultimate, this like luxury experience.
Yeah. EQS all the way. Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be hard to, Mercedes knows how to do that. You know,
Well, Tom and I have both played around with the Lucid. We did videos together on this car just, you know, months ago in New York. We saw it. It is going to be nice. No question.
Yeah.
Real nice.
It is nice.
But it's not nice, S-Class nice.
Yeah, we have a new video with Rawlinson driving it around, the CEO of Lucid, driving it around New York City. And, you know, I'm looking at the interior and it's like, man, there's just so much gray. It's like, it's okay, but, you know, it's not.
Yeah, well, you like, can spec beautiful like that. Colors, but the windshield's right. Neat, comes all the way up like a Model X.
Yeah, that is nice.
We'll see how well it works in hot environments, of course. But lots of good about the Lucid. I'm really excited about that car. The one, I just don't like the trunk. That's my only issue with it, really.
Right. What is S-Class a luxury that while Lucid might not be, is if it ever gets made, is Faraday Future. The interior on that vehicle is just like, you know, being in a private spa.
Right.
It really, you know, it's like Maybach Mercedes level, you know, not just Mercedes level. So we hope that Faraday is able to, you know, continue on and actually bring the vehicle to production. It's a totally different class. It's ultra luxury, you know, executive car, you know, you've got a driver, you know, but it's, I was able to drive in that up and down the strip in Las Vegas. And what an experience. Really, really, interior is absolutely stunning, super comfortable. They have these zero gravity seats where it feels like you're kind of floating when you recline them to a certain position. Really, really good stuff there. So I wish them well. I hope that they make it to production.
So Faraday Future has been kind of like a punchline almost in the startup electric, because they've had so many setbacks and problems and, you know, big grandiose plans and then it all falls apart. But now they have Karsten, I believe, from...
Yeah, he's the CEO. From BMW.
And then
Byton. Exactly, yeah. So I think, you know, he's kind of stabilized things a little bit and, you know... been able to leverage some of his, you know, relationships to get some funding. And, you know, it's they're still on tenuous ground, but I think they're moving in the right direction. So we're still well.
Well, we used a lot of time, but I did want to hit before we went out that Tesla had a record first quarter amount of deliveries. It's not their biggest quarter overall, but pretty close to it. Usually, like, so when they their fourth quarter is like the big quarter for Tesla traditionally. And then the fourth quarter, you know, everything like drops down significantly. This time there's like a difference of like 4,000 vehicles, which is not much at all, just a few percent. I don't even have the numbers right in front of me, but they're, let's see, the graph, yes. They were, so yes, 180,000 vehicles, 180,338 produced, and 184,800 vehicles delivered. And that's with like very minimal amount of Model S and X deliveries, zero production, and 2020 Model S or X product delivered, because they're still doing a refresh, which I've actually heard there's rumors that it's delayed by a couple months too. So there's that. But yeah, anyway, but congratulations to them. They continue to, you know, produce a lot of electric vehicles, still in my mind and the mind of most people, like the industry leader as far as like volume and getting cars out there. And that's just, and it's just going to keep on going like that with the Berlin Gigafactory coming online. So you'll get Model Ys in Europe, and then the Austin Gigafactory with the Cybertruck and more higher volume of Model 4. Yeah.
Can I mention something about Tesla real quick? Yes. Last week, you know how I mentioned my car at 80,000 miles and it's been perfect and I really haven't needed anything. I shouldn't have said that, because honestly, this is literally, Timon drove down to Dallas. I flew in, and he met me at the airport. I get in the car and it's squeak, 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 squeak. Turn the wheel, really loud, screeching, squeaking noise coming from the front suspension. And it happened, you know, of course, right after I said, you know, my car's been totally fine for 80,000 miles. So I jinxed myself. But this is the first problem I've had, and it's very minor. I think I just need a little control arm ball joint or something. But I'm not going to praise my car on the Inside EVs podcast anymore.
Okay. That's the Model 3, right? Model 3 Performance?
Yeah, Model 3 Performance that's been jumped, off-roaded, drifted, you name it, that car's been through it. And it's been honestly, seriously, very, very good up until this point. And this is, if this is the first problem, it's very much deserving of it.
Right. Drifted on dirt roads in Colorado mountains, I might add.
Oh,
right.
Yeah, absolutely. Track stuff, dirt stuff. Yeah, awesome. Awesome car.
Torture test.
It still can't match the durability of the Smart, though.
Nothing will match the durability of the Smart. You can take a tank. It's not even close.
I agree. And for one that has driven in that Smart, as Kyle off-roaded it around the track, you know, it's
brutal looking.
That thing is a tank.
I found one for sale this week, and it's the soft top like Kyle's got, which are pretty very rare to
Martin,
see.
Martin, you might just qualify to drive something like that. You might be cool enough.
It was $8,000 or $9,000, and I'm like, is that a conversation I want to have with my wife? Because if I start it, I can't go in, you know, with half intentions. I've got to be like, we should buy this car.
Right. And absolutely. Then you should tell her, I want to buy this car, and then take the drivetrain out and put it in one of the old Smart roadsters.
Yeah,
And I want to go
off-roading.
We never got those.
There's one in the awesome. Peterson, though, underneath the museum in L.A.
Cool.
Yeah. All right. Hey, before we go, Martin, can you throw up the last thing we have in our show notes here? So our North American editor-in-chief, John F., came across this Cybertruck camper thing called the Cyberlander. I think it's on Kickstarter or something. And he's got a background. His family sells RVs, like that's their family business. Well, he's not really related to that, but he's always amped up about anything camper RV related. And he also is a Model 3 owner. He has a Spark EV as well. So he's into electric vehicles as well. So he saw this Cyberlander camper thing. I think it might be a Kickstarter coming up, and it's pretty neat. We have you can type in Cyberlander with there's no E at the end, so it's just cyber or land or something. Anyway, you can find that on Inside EV's website and check it out. And if you want, we could maybe get somebody from these guys on the podcast maybe next week, even if you all in the audience want to hear anything about this, or if you're interested or not. So let us know in the comments.
How did they design a camper for a truck that hasn't finished final production design?
Yeah.
I guess they got the specs for the bed. I don't know.
No, they didn't. This is just a I mean, cool idea, but like we don't even know if the Cybertruck's going to look like that.
Oh yeah, I think it's going to be pretty much like what we saw. I don't think without door handles and maybe some small changes. I don't see any big changes.
Didn't Elon say like 6 months ago or 5 months ago something that we're going to see the final iteration of Cybertruck soon, and it's going to be different dimensionally?
There was some up and down smaller, the sizes, right?
Yeah, smaller.
Yeah, and then, first he said like a lot smaller than.
So this is a cool idea. Bigger. So here's what has to happen. They have to get Cybertruck has to come out. This company has to be near the beginning of the list. They need to then design, engineer, test, and validate one working prototype of this unit. Then they need to mass produce it for people who want to buy it. Very difficult. Props to them. I think we should have them on because I'm really curious what their plan is. Is this just someone who said, oh, I'm good at Photoshop, this looks great? Or is this a legitimate company who is qualified and skilled enough to make a production camper unit for their Cybertruck? Because if that's the case, this could be really, truly exciting. And I know if John's excited about it, it's probably legit. So I'm excited to see if we can have them on. That'd be awesome to ask them these tough questions.
All right.
Well, so, before we leave, we do have to mention it costs as much as the dual motor Cybertruck. Right. The dual motor Cybertruck is $49,990. This costs $49,995.
You're joking. So seriously?
It might be $5 more than the cost of the Cybertruck.
That doesn't make any sense.
But if you're willing to give them $5,000 today as a deposit, they'll lop $10,000 off the top of the cost, but it's only for the first 20 reservation holders. So if you want to give them a $5,000 loan with you know no real guarantee of getting that back because you really want one of these, you could save $10,000.
Look, I don't want to judge now. Maybe it's worth the money. Maybe it'll be premium. We can only judge when we get to test it. But I think the likeliness of us getting to test one. It's not very high.
Most campers are for trucks can be expensive. That's the thing. But we're right up against. We're way over time. So that brings us to the end of our show. I'd like to thank you all for joining us. We really appreciate it. If you have any comments about any of the topics on today's show, you can comment on the Inside EVs podcast post, the YouTube comment section below, or on the Inside EVs forum podcast thread. If you like the show, please give us a thumbs up. On YouTube, or if you're watching on a different platform, you can give us a rating there. Don't forget, you can find and follow our panelists on Twitter. Tom Logney is at Tomalog, Martin Lee is at EV News Daily, and Kyle Connor is at Avispec. I'm at Dominic_Y. Just click subscribe and tap that bell icon for notifications. And we'll see you all again next week. Ciao.